Well, good morning to you, and welcome to the Daily Connection here on KDove. 5 minutes after 10 o'clock, as usual, and you know what? It's a great day today. Got Matt McAuliffe and Chris White in the studio this morning, and it's time for another look into our past, as it were, as we consider some of the great saints and events that make up the Christian heritage that we have with us. And today we're going to be talking about a special lady. Have we ever talked about a lady before?
You know, to my knowledge, I think this is our first program of a woman figure in Christian history.
I think it is, by golly.
Well, it's high time we did that, because there have been many godly women.
Amen.
And who is it today?
Today we're talking about someone that I think we consider kind of a strange bird, Florence Nightingale. Okay, did you get that
yeah,
one?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Nightingale,
thank
strange
you. Bird, okay.
Anyway, we are talking about Florence Nightingale, someone who lived a very long life, born in 1820, died in 1910 at the age of 90 years old, and was a woman of devout faith in Jesus Christ, and literally, she changed the world of nursing and care for the sick to what we know it as today. That certainly was not true in her time. But I digress a little bit here, you know, just some of her background information. Florence Nightingale, she was actually known as Flo to her family. She had a sister, too, whose name was Parthenope, wasn't it? And they just called her Pop. So it was Pop and Flo, the two daughters.
Well, that's nice.
The thing. Girls were born in Italy, and so they named them after the towns that
they
the
were
girls
born
were born in.
And,
oh, by the way, I have to say, Florence was not a woman's name until Florence Nightingale.
Is that right?
Yeah, no, you can't find any Florence before
her. It was just a city before that.
After her, you can find many.
You know, that's amazing. That's a trivial piece of information
that
not even I knew about. And that says a lot, Matthew. Well, you know, Florence was actually born in the British aristocracy in Victorian England, the time of Charles Dickens, of the Charles Dickens books, and was a woman of great wealth and great privilege. At least she had that as her disposal. And she was someone who was really caught in kind of the backflow of that. Life for women in this particular time period was very predictable. It was expected that they were going to become well-educated and then marry a very well-placed man, both socially and financially.
So she was English or Italian?
She was English.
English.
No, she was English.
English.
Yes, her family was English. And,
rich enough to take three-year vacations in Europe.
Yes.
Yeah, you've been there.
The whole life of women in this time, in this particular level of society, was that of doing nothing more than socializing and making small talk and basically entertaining vast hordes of other socially prominent people. And Florence Nightingale, from a very early age, found this absolutely mind-numbing and completely boring and totally, it was enough to make her want to jab a lead pencil into her arm, you know, just to get out of doing this sort of thing. But the one thing that she did find from a very early age that really wound her watch, so to speak, was going out into the neighboring villages and doing community health. This was something that also that women in her social strata did. They regularly went out into the poor neighborhoods or poor villages and did something that you would call akin to community health care, where they just kind of took pity on the poor. They may have not have done this more than once a month, but it did something, I think, maybe to put a little salve on the guilt of their wealth or whatever.
And most of them did do it out of a sense of duty, but what made Flo different is that she loved doing it. She was drawn to it.
It was like the one thing in her entire month, you know, that she really enjoyed in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And so at this point, she begins to get an inkling, you know, that she's cut out for something different. And then something happens. We fast forward to about age 16 in her life. She has an epiphany, if you will, a vision of the Lord, a moment of callings akin to something you'd see in the Old Testament, where she has a sense that God has actually spoken to her and has called her to great things, and that this is the will of God.
Wow.
And it's kind of an interesting thing, Pat, because you know how all of us kind of, we kind of wish we knew the will of God for our future, or you know, we say, man, if I just knew God's will for my life. And God, I believe God spoke to her. This is something that's pretty huge in her life and is a constant in all the material we read about her. She struggled and suffered with this after 16 for another 14 years because God had appointed her to something, but she was unable to fulfill that call because of her social calling. And it was so hard on her that she actually came to the point of having a nervous breakdown on several points, a serious nervous breakdown. And so, you know, if you're one of those people listening this morning that is struggling with the will of God in your life and wondering about it and wishing and fantasizing that that may be a great thing of knowing what's up ahead for you, think again. It may not always be the boon and blessing that you totally imagine it to be. But
so it was a social barrier actually going down to be the servant that was the hard thing, rather than usually it's the other way around, trying to get back into the upper crust or something.
Exactly.
Well, and not only that, it's as if God came down and said, "You belong to me. I'm going to perform a huge, wonderful thing through you. Stand by."
And then put you
on hold for 10 years.
and so you're put on standby for, 14 years. And
didn't Moses have one of those?
Yeah. No, I'm afraid he
and
did.
Then, of course, you had the pressure, that Florence had, because it was expected she would marry. And she was an extremely attractive woman, very mm-hmm. enthusiastic, very lively, very attractive.
Brilliant.
By all accounts of her. And in her lifetime, actually had 4 bona fide proposals of marriage to very suitable men. But she turned him down, and she turned him down that she could not do any of these men justice being a wife. And she just realized that she had this calling, and this was very firm upon her life.
She knew it would consume her.
And she becomes inspired, really, to become a nurse. That's what she wants to do. And Matthew, tell everybody a little bit about what it was like to be a nurse. I think that's an important thing. For people to understand what it would mean for an aristocratic woman to want to be a nurse.
It was about as bad as it could be. I mean, in a nutshell, the whole medical establishment, I mean, doctors never touched their patients. Basically, if you were a doctor, you listened to the symptoms and you sat in the parlor and discussed theories on treatment. Anyone who actually physically touched the patient was, it was really bad. There was a caste system practically in the class awareness of England in that period of time. Surgery was done by barbers, nursing was done by prostitutes and alcoholic prostitutes. If you weren't when you started nursing, you certainly were after a couple of years, because you were looked down on and degraded and rejected. So when this beautiful, lovely, gifted, brilliant, educated young woman of the highest strata of English society in the Victorian era tells her parents, you know, I think what I'd really like to do is work in the sanitarium downtown.
You can just imagine the... you can imagine the warm reception she received at home from her parents about that.
Well, it was hard. One thing, just for fun, her mom was just a monzo social whirl person. She had gifts of administration and organization, because you had to in order to advance in society in that time. And we think Florence later got her gifts of administration from her mom. And her dad was unusual in that he not only gave her a classical education that most women had, the language, the classics, but he really let her get into areas that were nominally only for men in those days, science, navigation, advanced literature, he did chase her out of math, but oh well.
Being a father of 2 daughters, I know exactly what the phenomena was. Generally, when you have all girls in the home, one of them becomes your buddy.
Yeah.
You know? The other one counsels you on how to understand your wife, but the other one becomes your buddy. And I think that's what Flo was her father's buddy child, and that's why she got all that extra attention.
Well, didn't she start also reading, since she couldn't be a nurse?
She began reading medical books and studying and became conversant in science and had a great interest in that. But, one of the single big things that did inspire Flo was reading and learning about an order of deaconesses in Germany known as the Kaiserwerth Foundation. And these ladies were not Catholic, although she did have a brush up with a Catholic convent. They definitely told her, "You're not cut out to be a nun, so you can give that one up."
Mm-hmm.
But she was inspired by this group of Protestant deaconesses that had a hospital and a school of nursing up in Germany. And this truly inspired her life, and she began to see there was hope, and that nursing, something that was a job of disreputable women, could be used as a ministry.
Absolutely.
And she really caught a vision for that and had a desire to do this. And finally, at age 31, unmarried, sort of trouble with the parents, they finally release her to go to the Kaiserwerth School up in Germany, where she gets training and then comes back to London and gets her first job as working in a, really, if you will, a sanitarium for burned out and sick governesses in London. I they had a lot of delicate names for it, but basically I think it was like, man, you were...
It was a nanny hospital.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't blame them, being a governess. Oh, I mean, I've seen Mary Poppins. I know what they put these ladies through. But anyway, she begins caring for governesses in London and...
Does it better than anybody else.
Has ever done it. Begins, actually, at that point, she innovated the call button for the patient in bed to call the nurse for help.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
Ben and Dan, huh?
And then dumbwaiter.
And then comes the Crimean War.
Oh, my goodness. Right now, Florence is already kind of famous in London as a lady who has reshaped nursing treatment. And the Crimean War looms. This is 1853. Okay, real quick political nutshell. Russia needs a port in the Mediterranean. I mean, they need to be able to access their navy to the Mediterranean. So, and things haven't changed in 150 years. So the continual pressure on down into Turkey. And, of course, France and Britain, not wanting their routes to India threatened in the Suez, they're not having this, and Turkey either. So basically, that's what happens. So at the top of the Black Sea is a little peninsula, a little jutlet mm-hmm. out there called Crimea. And that's where the big Russian fleet in Sebastopol was stationed. And so all of the conflict was there. Okay, well, the situation is that much like when we were in Vietnam, after winning against Napoleon, the British military had just really got, they were a legend in their own mind, and incompetent officer corps, incompetent, riddled, corrupt supply sergeants. So they send out 60,000, 50,000 troops to Crimea in September of 53 or 54, and... Their battles are, people are getting wiped out.
Charge of the Light Brigade.
Yeah. Yeah, you 600 guys, go ahead and charge that cannon over there. It'll look good on the newspaper. And they're wiped out. So they have basically all these wounded people. Nobody even brought bandages. Nobody even thought to bring bandages. The medical staff is incompetent. There's no nursing. And in all fairness, the Russians were just as bad. The one thing, the French were actually pretty good. They were taking good care of their people. So once the newspapers got a hold of this, back home, what an uproar. It's just, you know, how dare you let our boys die in the mud like this? And it was bad. I mean, they imagine, well, this is what Flo came into later. Imagine taking a couple thousand guys, all shot to bits. You dump them in a big, giant building with no sewers, no water, no cleanliness, no doctors, no nurses. You give them a pint of water a day. Okay, you multiply that by 2 or 3 weeks, and you're beginning to see only in the vaguest reaches.
Oh, you're beginning to see what a typical man's apartment looks like, you know.
It was so bad.
It was an ugly thing.
It really was an ugly thing. The British soldiers were awesome. It was a macho thing. They just gutsed it up.
Stiff upper lip.
Yes,
stiff
indeed.
Stiff upper lip.
Well, the people back home just created such an outcry, and Florence was perfectly positioned. She had the administrative quality. She had the reputation. Her courage in nursing Londoners through the cholera epidemic, when no one else would go near a victim, she was the man.
She was the man.
So one of her old buddies, who had just happened to become Secretary of War, sent her a letter. Said, "Flo, please, you grab a bunch of nurses. Please get over there and bail us out. We are in deep weeds." And she says, "Okay, that's my job." Got on the boat. Off they went. And what she walked into, we can't even describe it. Christopher and I trying to come up with some adjectives
well,
we could
just
use
as
on
a
radio.
Just as an example, when she got to the hospital, one of the things she found was in one of the rooms was a general that had been dead for several weeks, and they just didn't feel like carrying him out. So he was just rotting in the hospital room there.
And in front of the lobby steps was a dead horse that the dogs had been working on for several days. The sewers underneath the hospital were clogged up, so you can imagine what we're talking.
And at the time, I think that she figured it out that 5/6 of the men in this hospital were dying from things not related to battle wounds, were just merely dying from diseases that were caused by lack of sanitation. Only 1/6 of the mortality rate was based on battle wounds.
Yeah, if you went into the hospital, there was a 42% chance you were not going to make it. And as a matter of fact, they lost 3/4 of the entire army in the first 6 months.
Wow.
Mostly to disease. So God love her. Here's Flo. She goes in. They stationed her. There were 4 hospitals right across from Istanbul. They'd bring the boys down from Crimea and dump them in these, we're calling them hospitals, they're warehouses. and just sail away. And so she got dumped here and just didn't even bat an eyelash, just went right to places that she really worked on were like in sanitation. She started getting crews out there cleaning the sewers out, emptying the bed chambers or the chamber pots. She had to purchase with her own money some boilers to clean sheets and to clean pajamas. Some guys were still in their month-old, blood-soaked, torn uniforms. They weren't bathed in a month. So she's working on all this. She opens the windows. She gets the light circulation going. She paints the walls white. You know, gets them on a cleaning schedule. The guys aren't being fed. She hires cooks. She goes out and buys pots to cook the meat in. Water. I mean, anything you can think of. Nothing had been done. And it just, so everywhere she turned, there was a way to, there was something to improve.
Couldn't go anywhere but up.
Oh, man. Administration as well. I mean, they would just take them and dump them at the docks, the wounded. And so there was no ambulance. There were no carts. If you made it to hospital because your buddies took you, great. And if not, oh, well. So she organized the Teamster ambulance thing. And what she did with 40 nurses, there's no way to describe it. There's no way our brains won't go there.
And one of the things she also did in the development of this hospital and bringing the administration together was the medical statistics that were not being kept on people. And she instituted a methodology of actually bringing statistics together on the patients so they could mark their progress, see what was working, what was not working. And that greatly enhanced medical care, especially war medical care.
Yeah, huge. In a few years, the British Army had better statistics than any army in the planet because of what she did. Well, this was not without a certain cost. Of course, the good results were that I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of lives were saved due to her efforts, but basically the British soldiers loved this woman. The officers had treated... Basically, one officer even complained that she's treating these brutes like men. What can I say? There was a real horrible classism, if you will. And the upper classes didn't really regard those lower guys, many of them, as honestly humans. So the men loved her. As a matter of fact, the name Lady of the Lamp comes because after 8 p.m., in order to avoid any hint of immorality, Flo would shoo her nurses off. And she was the only woman allowed to nurse the men after 8 p.m., and a few male orderlies would help her. And we're talking like 4 miles of beds, 18 inches apart. We're talking about like 7,000 guys. And she would do this, and she'd carry her little lamp around, and that's why. Just with a kind word, just a change in atmosphere and attitude towards the treatment of these guys, they started getting better. That 42% mortality rate dropped to 3%.
Wow.
I mean, it's mind-blowing, and not without some bad feedback, too. You can imagine what the Army doctors and some of the higher-up officers felt. You know, who's this dame getting in on our territory? And it wasn't until Queen Victoria came in on her side. They'd kind of exchange correspondence. And
Queen and Flo?
The Queen and Flo, and actually later became good friends. And Queen Victoria really got behind what Florence was doing, as well as a couple people back home.
But
what happened, when the Queen ain't happy,
nobody's happy.
Ain't nobody happy. So, yes, the generals found that they had to put up or shut up and just let.
And
Flo
the queen's
do
husband, Prince Albert, I think, kind of adored her a bit,
mm-hmm.
and even mailed her a special gift, a little brooch with a red cross.
This is fascinating.
That
yes.
That she wore. It was a medal that he had custom made for her,
She didn't like jewelry, but Queen Victoria asked her as a special favor to please wear this,
and so she did.
Yeah.
And it had the Queen's initials on it. You know, this was a Queen-approved thing.
A Red Cross. That was Prince Albert's idea?
Yeah. He had it made for her and shipped with the Queen's mark on it. And
it arrived towards the end of the Crimean War, that 2 years, and we don't have time to go into it all, but the fact is, after 2 years, she came down with fever, exhaustion, collapse. I mean, she's wiped out. She's physically ruined. And this little brooch arrives, and she pins it on and wears it. Okay, now here's the fun coincidence. the Frenchman, a few years later, after the Franco-Prussian War, creates the Society for Caring for Wounded and Underprivileged and Refugee People. And he says, gosh, you know, all of my inspiration for this came from an English woman named Florence Nightingale. And you'll never guess what symbol he adopted to identify this new international society of his.
Mm. Was it a yellow crazy daisy?
I'm sorry, Bill, what have we got for our contestants?
Is it a Red Cross?
It is a Red Cross.
And no kidding.
We couldn't find any official connection, but there's just no getting, but you do the math. I mean, this guy worships Florence Nightingale, and she gets the Red Cross and wears it around. That's the International Red Cross of today. Although the Ottoman Turks got a little huffy about it, and in 1906 they decided to add the Red Crescent. We won't go there. Long story short, Florence changed history, changed nursing, changed, went on afterwards and did improvements we have no time to talk about, but basically came home and instead of going out to the cheering crowds, hid out in her house.
Some people think that she had post-traumatic stress disorder, actually, in her life, because she did have a lot of the signs of that and lived basically as a recluse for the last 50 years of her life.
She spent
vast amounts of time in her room, you know, in private quarters, maybe a secretary or somebody helping her. But she really spends, actually, a very productive after this time. She's a national heroine. She has the respect and adulation of the medical world, of her nation, of really the world in general. She's called upon to advise, even in the American Civil War,
in
the military, all sorts of areas, and has a productive final chapter of her life, doing a lot of writing and reforming, and also starting Nightingale Schools of Nursing.
First nursing school in
Europe and in the United States. And so it's an interesting thing that here's someone that did suffer immensely after this, and yet was still very useful, even in her being more or less an invalid, was mightily used. She also had, we're going to have to say, some interesting, sometimes eccentric views of theology and God. She made a few attempts at writing theology and was actually told by some friends to please not publish any of this stuff. You are not qualified to write on these topics.
She grew up in a Unitarian home. Which
Unitarian and Anglican.
Really, yeah, which you almost question, you know, the Christianity of that. But and she even got advice when she was in Rome at that German deaconess school from a mother superior that ended up being one of the best counselors of her life and grew very ecumenical as a result of it. But Christopher and I really were hard-pressed as we were researching this, Pat. Gosh, was this gal a Christian after all? Because her ideas are so kind of wacko and out there. And what tickled us was that when the going got rough, because the overwhelming philosophy of that time was a theistic, rationalistic, humanistic type thing for explaining the universe. But when things got bad and she needed hope or she needed comfort, she retreated to the Gospel of John and at the end of her life said, "This is enough for me." She was kind of known as a mystical. Very interesting, but I'm pretty certain we'll be seeing Flo in heaven.
We certainly hope so. We have a couple recommendations
as far as
books and things if people would like to explore Florence Nightingale. And just a reminder also to those of you who might be even in college right now or preparing for a trade or whatever, and you say, "I don't see any connection with this in ministry." Remember that God uses prepared vessels.
Amen.
And you know, Flo had a call from God. She was in something she enjoyed. And God took something that really excited her and used her mightily in it and used that for ministry. We always like to think in terms of ministry being centered in the church, but not everybody needs to be ministering in a church. And being a nurse and being in healthcare is a unique and wonderful calling. And whatever else you want to do, do something that excites you.
The Heroes of Faith series biographies available at Evangel, I think. That turned out to be a real good biography.
All right.
And in honor of this, we're going to take a nurse out to lunch after this program.
Good idea.
We don't know who this nurse is, but we're going to do it.
We're going to take a nurse out to
also,
lunch.
There's a Florence Nightingale gift shop on the web, too.
It is totally unscriptural for a person to refuse to serve God. His plan is that you and I would be what? We'd